Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop. For this Thursday, January 24th, I'm Ray Graff. We have had our share of winter weather over the past week or so, and, well, frankly, it's not all that lovely right now. Perfect time to do a little spring thinking. And welcome back our gardeners. It's a gardening show, midwinter edition today on Vox Pop. Gardener Greg Ward is here of Ward's Nursery, and arborist Fred Breglia of Landis Arboretum. They are here to help you prepare your plants and gardens for spring. And as we'll learn, there's actually quite a bit of work for those green thumbs during the winter. Give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. It's the Gardening Show, Winter Edition, coming up right after the news. Hello, once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Joining me on this brisk, damp January day, snow on the ground and rain and sleet falling from the sky, to answer your gardening questions, a couple of familiar voices. Fred Breglia is director of the Landis Arboretum in Esperance, New York. Greg Ward runs Ward's Nursery, a lawn and garden resource in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. Our number, if you have a garden question on this midwinter edition of The Gardening Show, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Fred Breglia, Greg Ward, welcome back to the show, sirs.
Great to be back.
Yeah, happy winter.
Happy New Year. Happy
this is
winter.
Always one of my favorites. This particular Vox Pop in the middle of the winter. I know the spring is on the way.
There's hope.
you guys are already talking shop over here before the show started.
You know, there's quite a bit still happening right now in terms of gardening, in terms of pruning, in terms of arboriculture work. And I know, you know, Greg and I were talking about it with you before the show. But, you know, one of the big things is right now is dormant season. All the plants are theoretically asleep, and it's a great time to do pruning for a lot of species, not everything, but for some species it's actually the preferred time. And in particular right now, oaks are sort of in the news a lot lately. We have oak wilt, which is a fungal pathogen that's in the Northeast. It's in the Capital District for sure.
And that kills the oaks?
It does, and it's really fatal. There's no real good there's no cure once the oak has oak wilt. So the real thing is prevention. And one of the ways to prevent oak wilt is that oak wilt, the fungal pathogen, looks for new sort of entry sites to get into that tree, to get into the vascular tissue. And the easiest way for it to get in is usually pruning cuts. You go through and you do your routine pruning, and not even just live cuts, even just removal of deadwood is not recommended during the growing season anymore. But the best time is during the winter, during the dormant season.
Yeah.
And middle of cold, when, you know, not much is going around, the oak pathogen is at the lowest, very much not in the area. So we tell people, if you're looking to prune oaks in particular, there's no better time than right now. Get out there. And I've been even in deadwood, taking it out this time of year. If you know, you want to do a lot of structural pruning with a lot of species, it's a great time of year to get out there. I've been pruning a lot of oaks lately.
No, and what about maples?
Maples, you know, I typically tell people not to prune middle of winter, and because they're a bleeder species. Right. So when you think about maple syrup production, you drill the hole in the spring, and what happens, sap comes out. Well, if you make big cuts right now, those cuts are not going to, it's not the growing season. There's no time for them to really dry up or close up. So they're sitting there. And
you get that leakage later on.
You're going to get some pretty significant leakage.
Hmm. Which is not, in the end, it's not terrible, but it's just not, it would be better if that didn't happen.
That is correct, actually.
So summer pruning.
Yeah, I do typically midsummer pruning for, you know, when I say midsummer, I'm talking about middle of June through first week of August. Pretty much a great target time to do some pruning of any of your maple species. That's sugar maples, silver maples, even the Japanese maples. Great time midsummer because of that bleeding. And like Greg said, it's not actually going to really mess up your tree, but it's not helping the tree to prune it at a time that's not optimal. If you have the option,
and then
you wait.
Fruit trees, including crab apples,
mm-hmm.
Right?
Yep.
It's got That could happen now, right?
That could. Yeah. Oh. In fact, you'll see a lot of the orchards. Usually February is when they do most of their dormant pruning for their apple trees. And it's a great time for a lot of the fruit trees.
We had a terrible cold snap for at least a few days where it was very, very cold. Will that do a lot of damage?
Well, and I figured that would be something we would probably talk about today. But, for a couple of things, I don't think it's that bad, first off. Cold, the plants around here are used to cold and they want cold. In fact, if you look at places where we talk about climate change, trees that like it cold are actually slowly moving north. Mm. And trees that like it a little more southerly or a little warmer are actually also being able to move a little north because they're actually that southern zone is getting warmer. Yeah. So we kind of like cold. What we don't like is the fluctuations. And it's been kind of crazy. You've had, 40 degrees one day and, zero, a couple of days later.
Yeah.
And so those fluctuations are not great, but it's happening at a time in the winter when things are really asleep. The coldest temperatures, we had some snow on the ground for the most part. And so I don't think right now it's messed up too much.
And the weather has been, the light levels are still pretty low. It's been pretty cloudy. So there's not, though it has warmed up today to maybe 50 for a moment, it's very short run and it will be cold again. So I don't think the trees had any time to actually thaw out as well. It's all about that trunk changing temperature.
Yep. In the spring, the fluctuations, as we get closer to spring and late winter, that's going to become much more significant. We are going to want to, see it and be a little bit more consistent in temperature. Those fluctuations, because those trees are starting to wake up, those plants are waking up, can really have an effect.
Go ahead, Greg.
Well, I was just going to...
No, go ahead, man.
Okay, go ahead. So I was just going to switch to that winter mulching topic I mentioned a few minutes ago before we went on. Now for a lot of us, the snow is completely gone already. In Great Barrington, the snow is pretty much opened up. So I did actually 10 days ago go out and check my vegetable garden where I had planted the garlic, and it had actually emerged. What happened was the garlic cloves got pushed up out of the ground just a little bit and were exposed. Maybe I should have put them a little deeper. Maybe I should have done a little more mulching before the winter really came. Of course, I didn't, but I did go out there and cover with some compost all of my garlic, again, about 2 or 3 inches, a little bit of straw on top. And this is something that you might want to consider, any of that. There's a lot of different kinds of things that could use some winter mulch anyway, some small woody tender things. For the next few days, this would be a great thing to do.
And you're talking, when you say kind of pushed up, you're talking frost heaved, not an erosion
Exactly. Yeah. This was probably a little of both because of the 2, 3, 4 inches of rain we got in December.
Little combo.
That winter mulch is something that you're putting on and often removing. Again.
Especially with roses, really popular.
And so roses, Caryopteris, all of those woody plants that are often listed as zone 6, but you really want to grow them anyway. Butterfly bush is probably another one. They really will benefit from sort of being buried for the next 2 months with some kind of soil-like material. Compost is the best thing. Some people like to use mulches, wood chips and things. It's better than nothing, but something more solid is ideal.
Greg Ward is here from Ward's Nursery and Fred Breglia from the Landis Arboretum. It is a midwinter edition of the Gardening Show here on Vox Pop. And let's grab a call or two before the first break. 800-348-2551 is the number. Diane in Gilderland, you're first. Diane.
Hello. I have white pines, two of them in particular. They're about 5 feet in height overall. They were really healthy. I planted them as 2-foot trees about 3 years ago. And last July, when it was really hot and dry, I noticed that the top leader was wilting on one of them. And within probably 6 weeks, even though I really examined it, I couldn't see anything, but there were exit holes. And then I started really researching, and the best I could come up with it was that it was white pine weevil, which was confirmed by cooperative extension. So I cut it back to the first whorl, and it looks okay at the moment. But my question for you is, what effect is this going to have on other pines? I have everything from Norway spruce to blue spruce and everything from transplants to 10, 15 feet in height. And I was just wondering, what can I do, if anything, preventatively right now in a dormant situation or going forward? I'm desperate.
Yeah, that's a great, great question. And the diagnostic on that is correct. A dead terminal shoot where it would wilt and then eventually die, and you've seen the exit holes even confirming it, is white pine weevil. White pine weevil is considered by especially the lumber industry to be one of the worst pests for the white pine because it causes that terminal to die. Now, the good news about the white pine weevil, and I'll give you the good news first, is that it will never kill your white pine. So you don't ever have to worry about it killing your white pines. The other bit of good news is that it won't spread to any of the other species either. So it's specific to white pine, to white pine weevil. And the only thing that it will kill on the white pine is just that terminal shoot. And it'll move on to your next tree. And if there are other white pines around, of course, or your neighbor's yards, it's going to continue to try to attempt to kill those terminals. And it doesn't just do it on young trees. It often does it on larger trees as well. A lot of times the bigger trees, it's not noticed. But the big thing that you want to do with the white pine weevil, when you kill that shoot and you cut it back to the first whorl, which is the correct thing to do, what's going to happen in the future is that now you're not going to have a new leader that'll naturally want to come up, because those trees are what we call excurrent trees, meaning they always will have a central point, or they won't because something killed it, and then they form multiple codominant leaders. And for a tree like a pine or a spruce or a fir to have multiple leaders, real bad structure in the long run, and will cause it to fail. Okay. In terms of splitting. So what you want to try to do is take that first whorl and look for a branch that's coming off of that first whorl, and you want to try to train that back upwards. Now, when I do the terminal cut on white pine weevil damage, I typically leave, instead of cutting it all the way back to the first whorl, I'll leave a little bit of maybe an 8-inch stalk. And the reason why I leave that is I'll tie a lateral branch upright to that stalk. So I've got something to tie it to. And then I leave that on for about half a year.
Success in retraining leaders.
Yeah, it's really just take your time, retrain leaders. If you've cut the thing, the terminal all the way back to the first whorl, you can always put a little splice in there. But you are going to have to try to train a new leader and cut out competing leaders. Once you do that, the tree will go back to normal form. And you know, should be no problems.
I would just say, I mean, I believe the adults winter at pupate, right? Winter in the soil, and so they're going to turn into adults, fly around, lay eggs again.
Yeah, and then that larva is what is going to tunnel through and kill your terminal.
So there's no pre-treatment, that is going to be ideal. I mean, if there's small trees, there are these systemic insecticides you could consider, but really, generally, we don't see it happening in sort of an epidemic sort of way.
You
see it on one tree, and then it's very unlikely to see it on any of the trees nearby anytime soon. Maybe a few years later, you might see it somewhere else.
Okay, let's take a quick break here. Our number is 800-348-2551. Greg Ward is here at Fred Breglia. It's The Gardening Show. Yeah, don't check your calendar. It's true. We'll be back. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you. The number is 800-348-2551. It's The Gardening Show today. Greg Ward is here. Fred Breglia is here. And a couple of quick emails. And then we will go right back into the growing list of phone calls we have. This one's from James. And James writes, what's the best way to get rid of forsythia that has been let for decades and has grown out into the yard in waves about 30 feet? And what would be a good ground cover for a 15-foot slight down slope of property to the main road? That's two questions. Yep.
It is two questions.
You know, my first thinking is, and I don't know, he's not on the air, but I would say this. If you had a choice, eradicate, get rid of them, or have them all kind of brand new shrubs again, I wonder which one he would pick. If he chose the let's have all brand new young forsythia again, you wouldn't have to eradicate it all. You would just literally wait for this buds to begin to swell in the spring, and you could literally cut them pretty much, 6 inches to the ground. And although you wouldn't get any flowers that year, you would end up with brand new forsythia shrubs, which would need a little bit of shaping, and you'd be able to keep them all, and that would be good. If you wanted to get rid of them, timing on it is just the key. So instead of waiting for the buds to swell and then cut them, you would actually let the buds open and leaf out and then cut them. And it would use up all of its stored energy to put out this first set of leaves. You'd cut them before it had a chance to photosynthesize, and you would eradicate those shrubs pretty rapidly.
I'll just add that a lot of times forsythia that's well-established, ancient forsythia, does sort of spread out. Like the original plant is still there looking kind of big but and congested but tired, and then there's lots of other shoots, and those shoots don't often really develop in anything because they're growing with a lot of competition, maybe your lawn or grass.
Yeah.
So if you want to resurrect the forsythia, maybe taking up some of that newer growth, literally digging them up, bare rooting them this spring, cleaning up the N area or that area, removing, you know, in this case, now you're going to dig out. I'm suggesting you would dig out all the old stuff and reestablish these new young plants with some soil that's exposed around them, a little mulching afterwards, so that they regrow into brand new plants would be the best thing. Of course, if he's trying to put that ground cover in where the forsythia was, if that, then of course he would have to remove everything. And
right. And I'm not sure that the second part of the question has anything to do with the first. He says, what would be a good ground cover for a 15-foot slight downward slope of property toward the main road?
One of the things that we've been working with lately is barren strawberry. Waldestinia is this very sun-tolerant, very drought-tolerant, aggressive, low ground cover, beautiful yellow blooms in the spring. This is an herbaceous perennial. You would, again, clear the area first, remove all weed, sod, extra forsythia, whatever's there, completely open it up, plant, and then mulch that area so that those weeds, weeded areas don't grow back with something else right away until the barren strawberry takes over.
Okay.
If you wanted other options, daylily would also work. I like daylily for... They just seem to outcompete a lot of things. And if you wanted to go with something woody shrubs would also do, you know, certainly do really, really well as well.
That Rus aromatica grolo, that fragrant sumac that spreads out and grows, has been a very popular woody plant.
That is a good one. I know the plant. Yeah. It's ornamental. It's a great, it does really
great
well.
Great fall color.
Yeah, right, great fall color. Nice, fragrant too.
This one's from Pat. In the past, I've tried starting flower plants from seeds in the winter. The plants get leggy and die off before I can put them into the ground. What am I doing wrong? And that's from Pat.
Yeah.
Well, go ahead.
Well, I would say, you know, a couple things with seeds, you know, starting them too early or too late. You know, so timing is key. Light is going to be your best friend, and air movement. If you get a lot, you know, if they're getting really leggy, there's two reasons. Not enough light, probably number one. Two, getting a fan in there to move those stems, simulating what would happen in nature, creates really strong stem growth.
I think starting them too soon is probably most people's biggest mistake. If you're thinking of most things that people want, they want some zinnias, they want some marigolds, you really only need 3 or 4 weeks before you're going to plant them out, maybe 6 weeks at the most. So we're talking about April, starting these things in April, maybe even mid-April, certainly not in March.
Okay, so too early.
Yeah.
All right. This last email, and then we'll get back to the phones, is from Sue. And Sue writes, I purchased some tulip bulbs in November, was unable to get them in the ground before the first frost. Can I save them somehow or plant them in a container? And that is from Sue in Schenectady.
Yeah, definitely. Right now in the container, unfortunately, that ground is still frozen. But pot them up in a container.
Yeah.
Water it well. Put it in the bottom step of your exterior access to your basement if you've got one. Or set them in a garage or outbuilding where they can be cold, even freeze, but mostly stay cold most of the time. That bottom step is ideal because it doesn't quite freeze, but it's very cold.
Okay. All right. Let's go back to the phones now, and we go to Tim in Ballston Spa. Tim.
Yeah, a couple questions. I've always noticed on fruit trees that once you start to prune them, it's like a disease. You just get all these incredible number of shoots shooting straight up. I guess you call them water shoots. And so I tried my best to not prune, but I've got big leaders or big leader going up. Is there any way of dealing with that problem?
Yeah, those water sprouts, you know, not taking them off is kind of like the old, I don't know if this saying is even appropriate, but my dad always said, once you start shaving, you never stop shaving. Now, that could be coincidental with age, most likely, but it's sort of like the water sprouts. But what's the alternative? Do you just never shave? Do you never take them off? No, that's not really quite the unless you're an arborist like myself, it's not really a good option.
Well, you shave.
Idea is to shape the tree. That's the essence of it. And so if you want to keep shaping the tree,
yep. That's it. Those water sprouts will ultimately destroy the shape of the tree. And, you know, they are by nature a sort of a pioneer intermediate species apple. So by nature, they're designed to have some issues that happen. And that actually helps to lead to a decline eventually, which helps successionally the next crop sort of come in. But from a landscape standpoint, the last thing we want to do is, you know, let our nice investment in plants start to decline for no reason. And we can be a little more precise than Mother Nature in terms of dealing with a single plant. In terms of a system, it's hard to beat Mother Nature. Getting out there, getting those sprouts out is definitely the key. And
not really a solution, but it is something that I do on occasion on a few of my trees is do some summer pruning. Do a second pruning in late June, early July. You can even do it in August where you're actually removing what you would consider those water sprouts. So that when you get to fall, it's not a burden. It does actually reduce it. So you're actually still getting out there twice. You're still going to do all the pruning, but they're not looking as overwhelming.
Yeah. Another quick trick. You know, you may probably have a bunch of them coming up around the base of the tree too, which sometimes takes a lot of work as well. And if you have clusters of them and you know they're indeed water sprouts, and one thing to remember is that there's spurs and there's water sprouts, and they often in the young stage look similar, but a spur is where all your fruit and flower is going to happen. So you don't want to just strip out branches. You want to leave every spur and interior foliage you can, but you want to get rid of those water sprouts. And in the springtime, one trick I do at the Arboretum, because we have so many crab apples and apples, around the bases of them where you'll see tons of them. In the spring, they're so soft and succulent, you can get a pair of work gloves and just go out there as they're starting to just grow, and you could smear them all off. I mean, I can literally get rid of like probably 100 water sprouts in 10, 20 seconds with a glove. But once they get a little bit woody, that doesn't work, and you've got to get pruners out there.
All right. Tim, thanks for the call. Our number is 800-348-2551. Greg Ward is here. Fred Breglia is here. And now Jerry in Tribes Hill is here. Jerry, you're on.
Yeah, hi. You guys answered my question in part about the leggy transplants.
Yeah.
But is there any trick they use in the greenhouse to produce those short, compact, thick-stemmed transplants, you know, for tomatoes and peppers?
More light. So getting lots of light on the plants is going to do that. Again, the days are longer, the closer we get to spring and in spring. So not starting them too soon will also do that. That air circulation reference that Fred made does help create a stronger stem as well. So making sure there's a some kind of air circulation, a little fan of some kind in the greenhouse to kind of keep them just moving a little bit.
Yeah, and you want to time it. Your key with that is to get them so that they're moving, but not blowing down. And at first, if they're leggy at all, it's going to be a really gentle breeze. But as they develop a little stem strength, then you can increase that to some degree. And that actually not just applies to little seedlings; that applies to every plant that we put in the ground. That's why through research we know that staking trees is not necessarily recommended.
Yeah.
But sometimes you need to if it's in a spot where it's really windy and it's going to get blown over. You need to kind of – but the fact that tree can flex in the wind actually promotes tons of root growth. So not only do you get stronger stems, you actually get stronger roots. And if you get stronger roots, you get thicker stems and more abundant foliage. Fertilization is also key, if there's including all the micronutrients, trace elements. You want a complete fertilizer. If there's any little lacking thing, that can create weaker stems as well.
And then
are you talking with actual seedlings that you're starting? You know, you get the little peat pots that you put in water and they expand.
Yeah.
You would have to supplement those with some nutrients.
Absolutely,
yes.
I was just going to say that if you're not fertilizing at all, then that those plants should not get too leggy. But adding fertilizer to the mix is going to give them a little boost, which they may need some. But just overdoing it can get them to be a little too leggy. Using a compost-based soil will allow you not to have to fertilize for certainly that first 4 weeks or so.
All right. Jerry, thanks for the call. Gardening Today on Vox Pop, 800-348-2551, the number. Lisa in Saratoga is next. Hello, Lisa.
Hi, guys. So really quickly, I have a pear tree. I didn't know that it was a pear tree for a couple of years, and 1 year went out, voila, there were pears. And they were fabulous. I think it's Bartlett. There weren't a lot of them, probably less than 10. But last year I went out and I had, it was all flowered, beautiful. I had probably a bushel plus of little, you know, 2-3 inch pears they got to be. And then one day I went out and they were gone.
Oh.
They were just gone. Oh, I don't, there's an squirrels. Animal that, and they weren't on the ground. They weren't anywhere near ripe enough to pick. They were probably at a third of their fruit growth.
Yeah.
And I just wondered if you know any ideas. Did it, was there something that once they got to a size, they just fell off because they were too heavy?
Well, if you see them on the ground, then they might, they may have, some of them may have dropped. But, you know, the squirrel population last year, this last summer, was quite dramatic. Very lots of squirrels out there. And that's the most likely culprit. I mean, chipmunks can climb trees and take a small pair.
Really? So they'll
well.
Just go get them right off the tree.
Yeah.
And how do you stop that?
You know, I don't know really how well to stop it, but some kind of barrier. I would certainly witness it first. I wouldn't do all this before you see the squirrels doing the damage. But keeping the squirrels from getting on the tree, there, you know, you can use some of that netting. You could create some. It depends on how high branch the tree is. Usually pears are pretty low branch, so it's a little tricky. But some kind of baffle on the bottom of the tree at the lower.
Squirrels are tricky, though.
They right. are. You know, one tip to one tip to finding out for sure if that was the critter is I recommend trail cams, those little cameras that automatically take pictures when something motion triggers them.
Oh, sure.
And they're cheap. Mm-hmm. They're so okay. cheap. They used to be like worth, you know, quite a bit. But we use them at the Landis Arboretum just to monitor our what we call our resident population of various critters. They,
yeah.
you know, we get all kinds of really neat things. But it works really well. They're so inexpensive. You don't need a super good one. Just find, you know, a basic one that would work and set that up. And then you'll know for sure what it was. But I do agree with Greg that probably since you didn't see any pears on the ground, most likely it was a critter.
No.
And if it was a critter, the most likely candidate, if I had to bet, would certainly be a squirrel. But there are a lot of other reasons why fruit would fall off a tree, but you'd see evidence of that. So.
And because they were not even near ripe, we can rule out the neighbors.
That's right. Yeah, and a squirrel never, I don't think it ever waits for it to ripe. And in fact, if it's completely a ripe pear, I don't think the squirrel will take it.
Interesting. Yeah. Now, how many cameras do you have on the various sections of the Landis Arboretum?
We have quite, you know, an unknown number. I think I've actually lost count.
Really?
But at least a half dozen to eight or so cameras.
Do you review the feeds?
All the time.
Yeah.
We always check them out all the time. Yeah, we put them in different areas. We use them in old growth forests. We use them in meadows. We use them to see who's, you know, if there are any poachers coming in during
yeah.
hunting season.
Do you ever catch anything that, you know, gosh, you say, what is that, like a Bigfoot or something?
Mm. Well, you know, occasionally there are images out there that we can't quite identify. We don't usually put them up on our
yeah.
on our live feed
ah.
there or our news feed. But
so
but,
this is breaking news. There's a Bigfoot at the Landis Arboretum?
I, wow. I wouldn't say that, but we have seen bear
okay.
On property. We have had bobcats on the property.
Interesting.
We have thousands of acres of our land. Actually, it's contiguous. It's state land. I believe it's 5,000 acres of state land plus, and all the neighbors around us are huge 100-acre plus plots. So
yeah.
there's a lot of wild areas around here. But no, I can't say that I've officially caught a Bigfoot yet, but I'm looking.
It's a cover-up, man. It's a cover-up. Let's go to Abigail in Kingston. Abigail, you're on.
Oh, thank you so much for taking my call. I have a really interesting thing that I do. I boil all of the remains of the day that are non-animal, and then I use that to, you know, all the shavings from whatever vegetables, and I also collect other people's compost, because I'm a single woman at home alone, so anyway,
yeah.
but it makes for a wonderful, wonderful nutrition to feed my indoor plants and my outdoor plants. I also put into tin cans some shoots from a red maple tree. And so I grow my my new trees in pots. And so I am really enjoying the show.
Oh, thank you.
And very excited about spring.
Oh, yeah.
And thank you.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Great reference on basically a it sounds like a fresh version of compost tea is what she's making, which compost is a water-soluble nutrient source. People do work with that, and it's a great way to you could feed your vegetables.
We've had that on Food Friday. Yeah. Delicious. Yeah.
My dad's used it for years and years. He was, you know, organic farmer before it was trendy.
All right. Or you could make
compost
a nice
all the time. Manure
soup
teas
stock
too.
With that as well.
Soup stock? Compost iced tea is delicious in the summer.
I don't recommend the manure teas for the for the soup stock.
I think
that
you
is.
Make a good point.
But for the veggies, they're great. Tomatoes love them.
Yeah, I meant she had threw a lot of things in but the manure part.
Right. Well, that's a great spot to take a break. 800-348-2551. Yes, we're hitting mid-season form. It's the Gardening Show. Fred and Greg are here. We'll hit the home stretch in a moment. Vox Pop on WAMC, 1-800-348-2551. Gardening today with Greg Ward and Fred Breglia. Two emails and then to the phones we will go. This one's from Andrew. The subject heading, weeping cherry. Hello, when is the best time to prune a grafted weeping cherry tree and what is the general shape to aim for? And that's from Andrew.
That's a pretty fun one. Most of the time, so pink and white, two different kinds of weeping cherry. You should probably say that first. And my first thought was pink because the pink form, it's a Subverticilla pendula, is a big tree.
It can be a very large tree.
If left onto its own devices, those branches that look like a nice little umbrella today, or that maybe you've had it for a couple of years and they still look that way, suddenly start to take off, loop over, and this thing is now 25 by 25.
Yep, they can live to be 1,000 years old.
You're kidding
in Japan.
Yeah,
they're beautiful, beautiful.
Very, very ancient old trees.
And most of the time, people are not doing anything to that, except they suddenly say, oh, I have this branch that is not weeping. It's going straight up, but it's coming right from the head. And so usually, if you can tell where that graft is, which is that top grafted at 6 feet or so at the top of the original trunk, there's a shoot that is coming just below that graft that is not part of the weeping aspect.
Okay.
It is a more upright form, a seedling of just the straight Hagen cherry, I assume, usually. So that does need to be pruned off. And that's most of the time, that's all we're suggesting.
When's the best time?
Today.
Really?
Sure.
Get out there today in the rain?
Dormant pruning. Dormant pruning is great. If it's those little shoots, you could literally take those upright shoots pretty much off almost any time because it's such a small percentage of the total foliage of the plant. But otherwise, just like I would agree, just, you know, usually we leave them alone and they turn into beautiful trees. But there are occasionally people that, you know, say that those branches get too low and they kind of want to give them a haircut.
Yeah.
And you could trim off around the bottom if they get too low. I personally like that look, so I wouldn't recommend it, but it doesn't hurt the tree. That's an aesthetic question.
The white tree is a smaller tree, does tend to be thicker and grow
like
heavier
the snow fountains
to the ground, snow
and
fountain.
Stuff. Yep.
So sometimes taking off some of the lower limbs does make it tidier.
A little tidier.
All right, this one's from Gina, and then we'll go back to the phones. Gina writes, I have a 3-year-old Concord grapevine. Did very well year two, and then I pruned to what I thought were main trunks. No grapes last summer, just lots of leaves. Help.
I don't know if she got grapes the first summer. That said, 3 years is not a lot of time, and she does. It sounds like she was going in the right direction. You want to create a main leader. You want to create some side branching on some kind of trellis or support. And once you get there, a lot like we mentioned with the apples and these little spurs, these little short pieces of wood are where the flower and then fruit will come. So you're looking for those spurs. Probably she has them this year.
Okay.
Yeah, there's a slight chance something critter could have got them if she didn't notice them forming. I don't know if she ever noticed them form, or it sounds like maybe didn't see any at all.
Yeah.
So,
all right.
So most likely give it a little more time and you probably will have them.
Fair enough. There are a couple of more emails, but we have some people who have been waiting quite a while. Let's go to Rod in East Nassau. Rod, you're on.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
I was just wondering, should I prune my black raspberry plants, and would doing so actually increase their productivity?
So you should be taking out all the dead wood, all of last year's flower, fruit area. Those stems are now dry, and you want to clean those out completely so that you're creating good air circulation, removing any potential diseased tissue that might eventually cause some problems with the live tissue.
Now, is that when the stem turns like brown?
Yeah. So the newer stems are green to purple, the ones that came up this summer, last summer. And those are going to be the ones that flower for you this spring.
Okay. And will that increase the productivity at all?
Certainly decongesting the tree is going to help control having more room, more air circulation, just more room for those stems to grow. You can also shorten all of the ones you leave by a little bit. That does create some branching, which can create more productivity as well.
Okay. All right, Rod, thanks for the call. Now we jump over to Patricia in Guilderland. You're on.
Yes, I have a magnolia tree, and a friend told me that it has suckers coming up in it and they should be taken off. Is that true? Does it need to have something done? And if so, when?
You know, not always. A lot of times people feel like, hey, it's spring, you have one of these plants, you have to start pruning. Well, there has to be a reason to prune. So having suckers on it would be a reason to prune. And water sprouts are like suckers. Suckers come up around a base. And water sprouts are basically the same fast growth, but they occur up in the tree itself, so away from the base.
So
you could selectively take those off. I mean, other than that, deadwood. There's not a real lot of pruning that magnolias usually require. And if it's just selectively, deadwood can be removed any time of year. If it's a handful of suckers, they can probably also be removed when they're dormant. A lot of times magnolia pruning, I actually do it after they kind of bloom. You got to be careful because magnolias will set up buds. And if you're pruning them, you could eradicate flowers. So you got to make sure, you know, again, we're not taking away spurs. We're taking away just quick water sprouts but otherwise, there's not a real lot of work. They're one of those trees that don't require a lot of pruning, but a little bit.
And the only thing I would add is if the tree was originally shaped into a standard, one single trunk with a head.
Oh, yeah.
And it's now creating lots of shoots on that trunk or below or at the base of that trunk. Sure, you want to maintain the original shape, so you would remove those.
Yep. You do want to avoid just going up and down branches, and that's pretty much anything. And just taking away interior foliage. You want to try to establish a lot of interior foliage without having suckers or water sprouts to add to that foliage. You want to create it without that. So that means more spurs, more side branching, and more flowers and a healthier plant for you.
Fred Breglia is here and Greg Ward. It's the midwinter edition of the Vox Pop Gardening Show. Let's go to Lynn in Woodstock. Lynn, you're on.
Hello. I need to eradicate a large area of goldenrod, and I'm wondering if there's anything I can do between now and spring to do that, to really be successful at doing that.
I mean, I guess I would suggest not worrying about it too much and then just mowing. I mean, you may initially need, a little heavier duty mower than your lawn mower, but really within the first couple of mowings, even by mid-late May, you should be able to run it over with your lawnmower, and by taking it out several times this spring, it will dissipate. It will not come back.
Yep. Mowing is going to be your best friend for getting rid of a goldenrod. It can't live under a frequent mowing.
Oh, okay. So we might be able to take like a brush hog to get rid of it. It's property we just bought, so it's a mess.
Yeah, you would use in a big area, you would, use a brush hog. They make small ones that homeowners can rent. Don't need a tractor. They're self-propelled, like a DR kind of machine of some sort. But I've used them at the Arboretum. We use them for small areas, and they work really, really well. But once you cut it down, if you're seeing mostly goldenrod, a regular mower set on high would be where we would want you to go with this eventually.
Okay, Lynn, thanks for the call. The number is 800-348-2551. Dan in Amsterdam. Dan, you're on.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a cherry tree, another cherry tree question. I have a flowering Yoshino cherry that I planted about 18 years ago. Okay. It's always done really well. It flowers almost every spring unless we've had a really, really cold winter. But about 2 years ago, I noticed that some of the branches are not flowering and then they don't produce any leaves. And I was just wondering what might cause that and what I should do to help the tree.
Is the decline, in other words, the branches that are sort of showing that symptom, are they located more at the top part of the tree or the bottom part of the tree, would you say?
More in the top and towards the middle of the tree.
Yep, and that's kind of what I was thinking you were going to say. Usually when you see a top decline on a tree that's been doing good for a long time, it usually indicates that there's some kind of underlying issue, possibly with the root system. It could have a girdling root. I don't, you know, at this stage of the game, it wouldn't be a borer. It's too big of a tree to have a stem borer. You know, it's possible they could get into some of the branches, but unlikely. So my gut feeling would be that it probably has an issue with the root system of some sort. Now, one thing I would look for is to see if the trunk, and you may know the answer to this already, comes down straight and goes straight into the ground, or does it at the ground level flare out pretty dramatically? Do you know the answer to that?
Ooh, that's a good question. I think it flares, but I wouldn't say that it flares dramatically.
All right. Well, a flare is a good thing. If it has a flare, that means it's not planted too deep. And someone, you know, a lot of people say, well, it's 20 years old, Fred. How could it, you know, be planted too deep? Well, a lot of times problems that are with trees that are planted slightly too deep take 15, 20 years to sort of show up. It could even have spiraling roots, depending on when it was installed. And a lot of times folks, when they install new trees, they like to give them extra love, extra compost, and they're often planted in kind of rocky ground in those cases, or kind of compacted clay type soils. And so you want, your natural thinking would be, let's fill that hole up with, you know, a lot of good organics. But in the short run, even sometimes even decades, it does okay. But then you create a spiraling root system and it never really leaves the hole. And then as the tree gets older, it can create more problems. And in all of these cases, it would all show top declines. Those are things to check on. If you wanted to talk, you know, rule them out, look at it again as we get closer to spring or even in the winter, if we don't have a lot of snow cover, you can email me at fred@landisarboretum.org. I'd be happy to talk to you in more detail about it. You can send me some photos and I might be able to help you narrow this down. I don't know if you have anything.
No, I mean, I think looking, having someone look at it is really going to be the best situation. It is difficult to determine more than that.
All right, Dan, thanks for the call. We'll jump over to Warwick and Ken. Ken, you're on.
Yes, hello. Thanks for taking my call. I have a couple of lilac trees that always bloom beautifully. Starting about 3 or 4 years ago, they just weren't blossoming. In fact, maybe even closer to 5 years ago. And my concern is that they're 20 years old, but also everything else around them is 20 years old, and that they're just not getting as much sun as they used to. Yeah. I'm wondering if that's a problem, or if there's anything else that might just cause a lilac just to stop producing after a certain amount of time.
So definitely if the light levels are lower, that would certainly, add that stress to it, so that they're not getting enough growth during the brighter months of late spring, June, July, to set those flower buds, of course, getting enough to get leaf buds. And so they keep growing. The other thing is that if they need to be cycled, if your lilac bush has two or three very large, three, four, 5-inch diameter trunks that are doing everything, they're tired now. That after 20 years, it's better to have some kind of replacement for that. And so those lower suckers that are coming out of the ground are trying to do that, and allowing them to do that may be something you might want to consider. Without knowing the shape of the tree now, I wouldn't say to do all of this, but what you would end up doing is cutting down some percentage, 20-30% of the bigger ones, allowing some of the smaller ones to take their place. And this cycle could take a few years before they're big enough to bloom, again, as long as those light levels are there. So it could be one or the other or a little of both.
All right, Ken, thank you for that one. And now we go to Ballston Spa, and Sam in Ballston Spa is on. You go ahead.
Thank you. Earlier in the program, you talked about trimming oaks.
Yep.
And this would be a great time. And the disease or fungal infection, I can't recall the name.
It's called oak wilt, and it's a fungal pathogen that attacks it. That's right.
Okay. If trees would not be able to be trimmed at this time, but later in the spring or early summer, is there I know that would be taking a chance, would there be a sealer that you could put on those open trim points or scars?
You know, that's an excellent question. And, you know, when I do a lot of, I teach a lot of pruning workshops in at the Arboretum, at the flower show in Hudson Valley in the spring and things like that. And, you know, that's a question that people have asked, not specifically for oaks, but they want to know if those things work. And the research has proven that those wound sealers don't actually help seal wounds. Wound dressings, wound treatments, tars, any of those things have all been proven to not actually help seal wounds, but they sometimes have actually been proven to actually prevent wounds from being sealed, especially the bad ones. So are there ever times to use those sealers? And the answer to that is yes, but not to seal a wound, but to keep a pathogen, an insect or a disease, away from your tree. And although I would recommend doing it in the winter only because the pathogens are at the lowest percentage there, and by doing a spring prune or a summer prune, you are running more of a risk in terms of doing that. But if you are going to do that, a type of wound dressing, a sealer, would be something that you could use to help hide the fresh wound. And when I prune pines in the summer, there's an insect called a pitch mass borer. They come in and they look for new pruning wounds on pines, and they'll lay their little larva eggs and tunnel around. They don't kill the tree in this case. Oak wilt can, but I will use a product to hide those pruning wounds if I have to prune summer, and it's reduced the amount of pitch mass borer. So I think it would help. If you have no other option, you know, I guess that's something that's worth a shot.
And then just delaying pruning till mid, late fall would be another option?
Yeah, you could do November. The first month they recommend being able to prune trees without major risks of oak wilt would be like that mid-November. So if that's an option, it'd be better to wait till next year and do it in mid-November if you couldn't get in the winter. Otherwise, you know, possibly hiring someone to do it in the winter for you if that's an option.
Oh, there you go.
An arborist of sorts, or another tree care professional that knows what they're doing, that would be another option.
All right, Judith in Loudonville. Judith, you're on.
Hi. I was listening to your show, and I looked out the window at my weeping cherry, which is standing in about a foot and a half of snow, and it's got some white stuff that looks like, I don't know, probably a fungus. On two small Y-shaped branches. Any thoughts?
I'd like to see it. So if you wanted to take a photo and email it to to Fred or I or both of us.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah,
my gut feeling.
Where do I email it?
Well, you might as well give the contact information now, Greg.
Yeah. WardsNursery.com is the website. Info@WardsNursery.com. We'll get it to
info@WardsNursery.com. Okay. That's for Greg.
My guess would be that it would be a lichen, which is not a thing that hurts a plant. It's most likely a lichen, which uses the plant as a place to grow, and they often say it's a sign of good air quality.
Okay.
That would be my best guess as to what you're looking at. Hopefully it is, because that's a good thing. Fred@LandisArboretum.org.
Fred@LandisArboretum.org.
Yep.
All right.
Okay.
Well, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much, guys.
All right, you got it.
Quick email here. We only have about 30 seconds. This one is from Frank. We have a container red lime tree we bought from a local greenhouse. It's full of limes when purchased, full leaves about 5 feet tall. I've been watering it, also been spraying the leaves. Container is not sitting in water. Almost all the leaves have dried up and dropped off. Indoor temp is about 66 during the day, 63 at night. How to save long enough to get it out on the porch in the spring?
First thing I do is pull all the fruit off of it, even though it's not ripe, just because you want it to releaf.
Okay.
You know, now it's not going to pull any water because there's no leaves on it. So you're not going to, as he said, don't keep it exceptionally wet. 66 degrees sounds great.
Okay.
And just wait.
We are out of time, but thank you both for being here today. Support comes from Paul Smith's College, the College of the Adirondacks, offering degrees in management, natural sciences, hospitality, forestry, psychology, and more. Paul Smith's College, it's about the experience, paulsmiths.edu. Watercolors by Edith, Shutesbury, Massachusetts. Edith Hunsberger, a painter in acrylic and watercolors, specializing in portrait paintings of people and pets from photographs, edith-hunsberger.artistwebsites.com. Nine Pin Cider Works, Albany, featuring hard cider made from local apples, now serving pizza, light fare, beer, wine, and spirits in the tasting room. Open Tuesday through Sunday, ninepincider.com. And George Heigl Antiques, Ballston Spa, New York, offering estate sale services, including management appraisals and evaluations for individuals, families, and businesses. 518-396-6000.
7974. Thanks again to Greg Ward and Fred Breglia for being here. Thank you for joining us. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer, Dina Salzman, a call screener, Jim Lavulis, our producer. Tomorrow on Food Friday, we'll learn about healthy eating and dieting. Stand by for news.